lot of it is a lot of the going through the Bible and seeing what's applicable to the situation, and a lot of times you take that for granted, and it's just an eye-opening experience to sit down and make a lesson, because I'm not the best at sitting down and reading. It takes away all of the guts to the book, because I can't stop in the middle of a sentence and analyze it and break it down. But if I can go through on certain topics and find passages that relate to it, then it really helps me out. So if you ever feel like it, just create a lesson on a topic, and you'll find out a lot about your faith. So I have a bunch of headings up at the top, just to help guide y'all along with me. We'll just get into it with the first one. What is euthanasia? So it's a Greek word with eu meaning good or well, and thanatos meaning death. It's good death, which means usually people say it's a good, easy death, and it's to end your life on quote unquote your own terms, and to skip out the natural processes that come with dying, which usually entails suffering and embarrassment in some cases. So we need to just keep a critical eye in these days on what people label as good and what people find as good, because we see that God created us in His image, and giving our lives worth through His image, we see that pain and illness is rendering life not worth living, or people are devaluing our lives because of certain illnesses or embarrassments that come with life. And we'll go down to the next heading, life's inherent worth. This is probably the biggest topic that's covered in the Bible. We saw it last week with Clint's lesson. We see it all. Just without this subject, we wouldn't know why God died for us. I mean, we could say that God loved us all day long, and we could say that everything around us is example of His love. But honestly, why does He love us, and how does this break down? And so we go to Genesis 1:26-27 again, and we see again that God created us in His image. He created us like Him, and we see this is where our worth is, and that it can't be lost. That even through sickness and embarrassment that comes with life, that our worth can't be decreased. So that in decisions you make, you always need to keep this in mind, because whether you are seen in society's eyes as less worth, or you have a lower value, you always have the value that God has given you in His image. And we see that all throughout the Bible, we see God's love. We see that He takes care of us in the womb, and He watches us being formed. He watches us being woven in the womb. And that's in Psalms 139:13-16. And it's just made wonderfully clear the perks that come with God's love, and the perks that come with being made in His image. And it all comes through a culmination in John 3:16, where he makes the ultimate sacrifice, because He loves us, because we're made in His image, and He wants to give us a chance to live eternally with Him. And And yet, even with all of these examples, we still tend to find a way to ignore him or disprove him or just forget him. And it's laid out in Deuteronomy 19 through 20. I'm going to go ahead and read that real quick. So, it says, "Today I invoke heaven and earth as a witness against you that I have set life and death, blessing and curse before you. Therefore, choose life so that you and your descendants may live. I also call you to love the Lord your God, to obey him and be loyal to him. For he gives you life and enables you to live continually in the land of the Lord promised to give to your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So he gives this saying where he says, I've given you a choice. You love me and choose life, or you die and you don't get to live with me eternally. So he gives us this choice, and he says, this is how you choose. You love me, you stay loyal to me, you have faith. And we go into this next section, and we see a man named Job. We go through the book of Job, and we see that Job was a man regarded by God as blameless and upright, as seen in Job 1:8. And we see that God calls him one of his most faithful servants, that he fears God, that he's again blameless and upright in his eyes. And we see a day when God's children, or the sons of God, gather with God up in heaven, and we see that Satan is there. And you know, God just addresses the elephant in the room, and he says, "So Satan, where have you been?" And he says, "I've been on the earth, I've been up, I've been down, I've been across, and I've been side to side." You know, he explains. And God says, you know, I have this guy that you might not have considered yet, and his name is Job. You should check him out. I don't think you could get him. He fears me, he's blameless, he's upright. He follows me wherever I say. And we see Satan say, I accept. And he's so confident that he can get Job to turn that he says, he will curse you to your face. And so we see this man who's blameless and upright, who I need to explain. He had been blessed by God. He had plenty of livestock, he had plenty of land, he had plenty of children, he had a wife, he was very blessed, he was living a very comfortable life. And so we continue on, and we see that Satan accepted, and Satan goes on, and he lays all of this turmoil into Job's life, and he sort of slyly pins it on God, like, he sort of slyly pins it on God, and so Satan kills his children, allows his livestock to be taken by foreign countries, foreign
raiders.
Yeah, foreign raiders. He just brings complete hell into his life. We see that he has these three friends who come and meet him and see that he is in complete turmoil, and they rip their clothes for him. They say, "Man, this guy's going through some stuff. We should stay quiet for 7 days and then we'll talk to him." But when they start talking to him, all they can say is, "What have you done wrong? What where did you go wrong to deserve this punishment? Because, I mean, we can't find another reason that you would be going through all this stuff, so it must be punishment from God. And Job, instead of defending God, defending that God is in control and God will basically do as he pleases, he says, I'm blameless and I'm upright. And he builds his ego in this way, and he starts building it, and they go back and forth saying the same thing over and over again in different ways, saying, obviously you've done something wrong. There's no way around it. And Job just continues to say that he's blameless and upright, that he hasn't done anything wrong, that he is righteous. And in the end, we see that Job finally lets his ego get the better of him, where he slips up and he sins. He begins to contend with God. And so it's Job 31, 35 through 37. Flip there really quick. So, if only I had someone to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. If only I had an indictment that my accuser had written, surely I would wear it proudly on my shoulder. I would not bind it on me like a crown. I would give him an accounting of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. And we really see right here his ego getting the better of him. He says, if only someone would listen to me, if only someone would hear my side of the story, and saying pretty much that God doesn't know the whole story, saying that if God told him if he had done something wrong and what he did wrong, that he would argue with God, saying that giving an accounting of his steps, and he just goes into this completely sinful ego trip that puts him on the edge. And then we see this next guy, Elihu, who sort of steps in and puts him in his place. He says, you know, you have been arguing this whole time for yourself and not for God. And he calls both sides out, and he says to the friends, you have found nothing wrong with him, yet you indict him, and you say that it is punishment from God. And we see that this plays into all of the turmoil and the pain that he's feeling, that he let it get the better of him, and that he went into this sinful state. And we see his struggles, we see the arguments that go on, and we see that Job is in a state where he wishes to die, where he's wishing that he had never been born. In Job 3:3, he curses the day of his birth. And we see that in no situation is he asking to be killed by anyone other than God. He's not saying, friends, put me out of my misery. Friends, I'm going through so much stuff right now, and you are convicting me of something that I didn't do. Put me out of my misery. Let God be the final judge. He's not saying, I will do it myself. I will send myself to God, and I will argue my case. He's not saying anything of the sort. He's not saying, I'm going to die so that I can contend. He's saying, God, kill me so I can be put out of this misery. And really, who are we to contend with about life and death other than the person who created, other than the God who created life and brings death? And honestly, that's a good question. I mean, we see nowadays that people are contending or are asking humans to kill them and to end their lives, and we forget that God is the controller of life and death, and that he will ultimately decide the day of our death. And so I just sort of wrote out two things that I learned from the book of Job. And it's one, that God does not stand to answer to you. He may test you as he will. Basically meaning that God is the judge and that we don't judge him. His actions are not to be questioned, basically. I mean, but we everything we do is to be judged. So, and then the second one is, God is a God of justice. That in the end, Job was restored twice over. That his life did not get progressively worse. That he was restored to even better than he was. Not saying that everyone will be restored in this life, but in the next life, we will be rewarded for our faithfulness and our word. Yeah.
Faith.
Yes, that's a good word.
Not the one you were looking for, but it works.
All right. So the next topic is really, where will it stop? You know, we see a picture of people being killed because they believe to be justified and they're yearning for a peaceful death. But it's a sad mistake, because we are giving those who are killing us a power that is only held by God. Ecclesiastes 8:8 says it perfectly. I gotta find that real quick. I didn't look that one up.
I haven't.
You got it?
No man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind, or authority over the day of death, and there is no discharge in the time of war. And evil will not deliver those who practice it.
So no man can choose the day of his death. The day of death. And as I wrote in here, which while it is true that no man can choose the day of his death, we give these people illusions that they hold life in their hands. We give these doctors the thought that by administering an overdose of painkillers, or by doing anything to kill us, that they hold life in their hands, and they are giving mercy. That they have the ability to give this mercy to someone and to kill them before it is their time to go. And so, before long, won't we see these same people killing other people because of their own convictions? Because they believe that people with autism aren't worth what a normal person is worth. We give these people the illusion that they hold life and death in their hand, and then we expect them to hold to a godly standard, to say that all life is worth living, that all life is valuable because it is made in God's image, and we can't expect that from other humans. Unless they're kept accountable by the Bible standards, and that's something that we can't do in this day and age, because not everyone holds to the Bible standards. And so, where will the powers we put in human hands end, and where will we draw the line? And I think this rolls over into capital punishment pretty well, because we get the value of life, we get the value and worth of life, but we don't see that value in causing death to someone else who has caused. I mean, where is this? I mean, let's get this out of the way. So, it's important to define terms in this case, and the Webster Dictionary definition of capital punishment is punishment by death. The practice of killing people as punishment for serious crimes. And I just lost it. This definition poses a few good questions to Christians who might not have a specific view on capital punishment or whatever. So we'll just go through these real quick, and I have some answers. So isn't killing murder? If not, where is the line drawn between killing and murder? Is this an outdated practice? Doesn't the blood of Christ cover all sin? So let's just start from the first one. Which the question was, isn't killing murder? So after the flood, no, that wasn't the first question, is it?
Yeah,
it was. Isn't killing murder? So
you're saying it wrong.
After the flood, murder. Wiping out almost the entirety of the human population for its wickedness, we see a scene where God is telling Noah and talking to Noah and telling him how to carry on and populate the earth. So I'm going to turn there real quick and read that. If anyone got it, you can read it. Go ahead.
Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands."
Through six.
Okay. "Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man, too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by men shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man."
So we see there an important picture of this thought of capital punishment, where capital punishment started, and if it was really ordained by God. We see God telling them, whoever sheds human blood by other humans, must his blood be shed. So This truly is the first picture of capital punishment, where if a human sheds another human's blood, then someone has to take account for their action. So it was truly given to us as a way of keeping our brothers accountable by saying, if you kill someone, if you do this unspeakable act, then you will be held accountable. Your blood will be shed by another human. And so we get to the next question, and we see that the question asked is where the line is drawn between killing and murder. And we see that it's clearly drawn in Numbers 35:16-34, and I'll just read a little bit of that, because it's not all necessary, but it's an important reference. But if he hits someone with an iron tool so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. If he strikes him by throwing a stone large enough that he could die, and he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon so that he could die, and he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. The avenger of blood himself must kill the murderer when he meets him. He must kill him. But if he strikes him out of hatred or throws something at him intentionally so that he dies, or with enmity he strikes him with his hand and he dies, the one who struck him must surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. So we see this line drawn where intent is the line that is not to be crossed, where if there is a hatred or enmity in your heart towards this other person for the act they've done or for their life, then you are now a murderer. If you kill someone with hatred or enmity in your heart, then it is murder. And so let's move on to the next question. Is this an outdated practice? You know, I think this question is asked about a lot of stuff in the Bible, and we see it continually be pressed as an important question. And just one example that Stephen gave to me was the Boston bombers. And here we saw two men who set off multiple bombs at the Boston Marathon, murdering many people and wounding others. And there wasn't really a lot of discussion throughout the nation on when these guys were captured about whether they should live or die. It was these guys that committed an atrocious crime, and they should die for what they've done. And it really shows it is a testament to the words of God being written on man's heart. And we still see that it is a important part of our society to keep others accountable, to keep others accountable for what they've done, including the death of someone who murdered innocent, quote unquote, innocent people. So, I mean, you can decide for yourself if you believe that if it's an outdated practice, if you believe. But this next question might help to clarify my side.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, just a little bit on that. What's interesting is that 9/11, any kind of terrorist act that's a crime against a large group of people, I think most people would agree that whoever gets caught should be punished as such. But a lot of those people who believe that aren't real consistent about the death penalty and how it should be carried out. So if a man takes another man's life in the act of a crime that's not considered a terrorist act, then that shouldn't be punishable by death. So there's this, even though it's written on our hearts, we cannot rightly decide, I guess we cannot perfectly decide who deserves who deserves capital punishment and who doesn't. And so there's an appeal to us as humanity that the crime should be punished by a like punishment, or the punishment should fit the crime, right? but it's not carried out consistently. Matter of fact, it's highly hypocritical in most cases, because it's okay to do it here, but it's not okay to do it here. And it with God out of the picture, it doesn't get done correctly. So that's where the forward.
So God gives us sort of rules on how to carry out and when to carry out this punishment, and it's not held to most of the time. The standard is not set by the Bible anymore. So let's get on to this next question to help clarify my side. And it's, doesn't the blood of Christ cover all sin? And the answer is yes. The blood of Christ has even covered the stain of murder. But there are some cases in which all men would agree that we should leave the final judgment to God. That by killing a murderer or rapist or a pedophile, that you are extraditing them back to be convicted or have the charges annulled by the one who knows all. So, I mean, it's really a... because we can't always get it right. We're humans. We sometimes cheat the system. We sometimes go around the systems. And sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. But in the end, if this man is convicted on earth of a crime that is... that was committed, then it's ultimately up to God to dole out the punishment. And so we see this as the final judgment, and I truly believe it to be an extradition order. So as we continue on, the Bible has some guidelines on how to sentence someone to death. There must be at least two witnesses, and if you can't resolve the conflict, if you can't agree on whether this guy should be put to death, then there was a Levitical priest who was put in place by God, who would ultimately decide whether this guy would die or live or die. And we really have drawn away from that in our society because of it's not politically correct to, it's not a separation anymore. You have to separate church and state, and we can't carry out such, I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah. So it is also noted that the death penalty is to be carried out with no emotion except for love. We see in Numbers 35, 16 through 33 that intent is where the line is drawn between murder and killing. If we kill with hatred or enmity, we are murderers and we should be put to death ourselves. This draws a lot of questions, like such as when we get into the New Testament and we see that. Let's just use this example that I put here. So the woman that was caught in adultery that Jesus saved, and doesn't it say that women who commit adultery should be stoned? And this is a really tricky one. Not really, but yes, it does. But Jesus was smart enough to see the trap that they laid for him. And he saw what they were doing wrong, and he sort of pointed it out to them. One of the things, or a few of the things that they did wrong were they didn't have the witnesses to testify against her. There was no discussion of witnesses who stepped up against her. There was no man with her who committed adultery with her, which is said that they should both be put to death by stoning. And And there's one other situation where if a woman says she's a virgin and she's not, that she's to be brought to the doorstep of her father and stoned there. And we see that none of these situations are fulfilled, and that they aren't going with the law, that they said by the law of Moses that we should stone this woman, but they weren't following the law of Moses. So they sort of get told off by Jesus. They said, "You who is sinless, cast the first stone," and they all trickle out from there. And so there were a lot of stuff that we saw that were punishable by death back then, and I listed out a lot of them. I don't know if it's all of them, but it's what I found. So I'll just read them out real quick. Murder, rape, sodomy, adultery, bestiality, incest, false witness involving a capital offense, kidnapping, witchcraft, human sacrifice, blasphemy, striking or cursing a father or mother, non-correctable juvenile delinquents, sacrificing to false gods, contempt of court, Sabbath desecration, and a priest's daughter who fornicates. You know, there's a lot of things on this list that people nowadays would just be dying left and right, because we see so much of this stuff going on. We see people blaspheming, saying just completely ridiculous statements that about how they're gods of their own societies and their own situations, and there's just a lot of stuff people would be dying for nowadays if we functioned under the systems of the Mosaic Law. And it's really just a conviction about how if we were living during Jesus's life, how vulnerable we would be if we had been raised in our society back then to being killed for what we're doing nowadays. It really is just extremely convicting. And so I just want to end with a little note. As we travel into an era that is valuing human life less and less, it is important as a Christian where you stand on topics such as these, because while the debate is going on, these topics have sort of been progressing, and we haven't been able to see them because of the total media blackout on with the
election.
That's the word. So it's just important to know where you stand and to be active in fighting against it. And I hope that you don't take my word for it, that you study it yourself, that you find out your own convictions and your own thoughts about these subjects, and really where you stand on it. Because there's a lot of things, especially with euthanasia, that you can get caught up in, like you see an old 95-year-old with, let's say, dementia, who might forget who you are, who, let's say you're her son, forget who her son is, forget who her doctor is, forget everything, forget how to use the bathroom. And you see her life just in society's eyes decline in value because she's not able to work with her hands. She's not able to provide a service, to provide anything. And we know, we should know as Christians that value is not coming from our own abilities or word. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's it.
Good job, Nathan.
Yeah, thank you.
No.
It's time for discussion.
Yeah. All right, cool. So, because I remember you were saying it was either towards the middle or the beginning, or it was at one point, I don't know.
Yeah.
You said it. You said it. Let's just go with that. You said it. And it was like, killing is, it was like murder would be if there's like hate in your heart or something. So what if so this is the situation, the scenario. Someone comes into my house, and I'm sleeping, or whatever, I don't know, just something happens, and my family is just brutally murdered, and the person sees me, and I'm there, and I see that he just did what he did, or I see him, like, finishing up, or something, and he's about to leave, or something, so I kind of, like, stop him, and he just doesn't want to kill me, I guess not, and so I end up, or for some reason, I end up getting the upper hand, and I end up, like, beating him up and ended up killing him in the process, would that technically be,
are you saying that you had hatred or enmity in your heart when you were beating him to a pulp?
I mean, yeah, but like, wouldn't you know, like, but that,
then that's murder.
It's still murder?
It's murder.
Actually, the law,
isn't that like a crime of petty? Like, can't you?
No, the law, if you, with the gun, you know, the concealed gun licenses,
mm-hmm.
If a guy is trying to get away and they prove that you went after him to shoot him, then they'll throw you in jail.
Yeah.
So if there's no threat on your life and you take a man's life, then that's revenge. That's really avenging the
not
death.
That
now, if you were stopping them from killing one of your family members, that's different.
Oh, okay.
Once that killing has occurred and there's no longer a threat on your life and you still kill him, then that's where the tables turn. And that's when it becomes your responsibility for doing the right thing there.
So like they're about to
now
stab.
You can hold him at gunpoint and say, I will blow your head off if you move another muscle, and then you call the police for him to come. Or you can even subdue him and tie him up, but to kill him would be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Kneecap him.
Yeah.
So
I shoot him in the knee.
So hard finding.
Yeah. Shoot him in the butt.
Shoot him in the
ear. And you're one more time.
Shoulder.
Elbow. Wrist.
Shoulder, knees, and toes.
So expanding on Josh's scenario, what if, you could do that? He's coming into his house. Josh realizes he's about to kill his family, and he kills him for that, like, preventing another evil from happening.
I'd say killing in the defense of others to prevent murder.
It's not murder.
But he also has hatred in his heart for him coming into his house and trying to kill him.
Then that'd be murder.
Like, would that still...
No,
well,
you gotta distinguish.
You should make a self-defense lesson, because self-defense or
that's
national defense is...
It's almost a whole other topic. It's like,
no,
but
that's a good question.
There's going to be a lot of questions about is war.
How does that
war
mix in your heart of which one is the overriding cause of the action?
Murder.
Is it defense of life, and is it justice in that sense, or is it hatred and revenge? And you have to distinguish the two. And I'd say there's probably a mix, and you. Yes,
I feel like
you commit a murder.
I feel like in the
there's
moment,
hatred in your heart.
In the moment, like, if it's your family, the family that you love, I feel like the protecting, say, like, two of them are down, and there's one more, I think the protection, I mean, I've never been a father, obviously, but I feel like,
thank God.
Father would be, thanks.
That would be a nice story to hear.
But, like, I picture a father like being like, okay, well, I'll do, like obviously
going
this,
to save
like,
the last
split,
one.
Split second thought, be like protect my family,
like, whatever, do whatever I can to have the family that I have. And that's a split-second thought. You're not going to be like, well, I could just be mad, but I, you know what? It's like a split-second.
No, I want to protect.
But shooting is...
Yeah, it's
like protecting the sanctity of life.
If there is that... If there is that will to protect, then you don't have to worry about whether or not you you were wrong in killing this offender.
Exactly.
But even if you were, even if there is some mixture of murder mixed in with the killing, to use that language, thankfully, as Christians, Christ's death covers that sin.
Right.
Plenty of murderers we can point to in the Bible who are God's favorites, if you want to use that language again. But so... Should you defend the lives of your, even if you might have hatred in your heart in the moment, I would say still yes. The good is still necessary of protecting and defending those who need help.
Yeah. And there are many cases there's a moral obligation when you get into just war and.
Which we covered in the war lesson.
Yeah, we did.
For those of you
but there is a if you have a moral.
There was a war lesson.
Yeah.
The difference between murder and killing.
Yeah, if you have the ability to stop somebody else from being hurt, and the only your only option is to, well, kill them, then there's a moral, there's an obligation to that from that standpoint. Now, I will say this on the... Did you want to say something?
It's a little bit difficult.
What I was going to say about... So you read that list that Nathan gave us, and I'm guilty of murder because I've hated somebody in my heart. I'm not guilty of 2 and 3 by the grace of God. Adultery, I want to tell you right now, I'm confessing before my wife, she knows this, but I'm guilty of adultery. And not from the physical act itself. 5 and 6, I'm okay. False witness, not necessarily involving a capital offense, but I lied. Blasphemy, I've done that. I've cursed my mom and my dad on multiple occasions growing up as a teenager. My point is, and I'm I think we all can say that we would deserve death under this list, right? But this, the law that the capital punishment in particular, you have to understand that the Jews were set apart for God's glory. And they were supposed to be they were supposed to model God's character to the world. And so in order for them to do that, they had to be different. And all the everybody around the Jewish nation was doing these things. Yeah. And that's why when God told them to go in and wipe out everybody, he was trying to keep the bloodline pure. But because they mixed with these other countries and nations, all this stuff happened. Okay? Now, that's why a lot of this doesn't apply today. But God also gave us the law. It gave us the ability to govern ourselves. Laws are laws. Practicing capital punishment is well within the scope of biblical practice.
Yeah. To give you guys another little framework to kind of think about these ideas, two distinctions I would make. First of all, where he started with Genesis 6 is one of the key passages on this. When Noah gets off the ark, God says, "If man sheds a man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." There's no question there that God is introducing capital punishment as a means of keeping humans in line with each other.
Yeah, order, making order, right?
The only question for Christians is, does that still apply? And so you can wrestle with that. And I would say yes. And I would say it's not even like one of those things where we can say, in Leviticus, this law doesn't apply anymore. This is before the Mosaic law came along. This is a completely different dispensation. And there's nothing in further revelation that would say that this law is no longer applicable. This is kind of, as long as we're still eating meat, we're still allowed to practice capital punishment, is how I would put it. Because this is the same place that he tells us all of the food, all of the animals are food for you. But another kind of thing to help you organize your thoughts on this would be making sure you have a clear distinction between the idea of society in a passionless, emotionless system instigating a death for punishment and revenge of one man killing another.
Right.
It is not up for one man to decide whether or not another man should live or die. It is up for, as God laid it out, it's up for a society to decide it. And in particular, I like that Nathan kind of, they had a system. Like, you had to have two witnesses. There was a certain protocol you had to follow that took the passion out of it. This isn't just reacting and killing a man out of anger or enmity in your heart. It's sins were committed and payment for those sins was given. All that, though, there's still this question of whether or not Christians should be pro-capital punishment. And I'm not confident enough to say that Christians definitely should be against capital punishment or for it, one way or the other. There are some of these that we've talked about, like abortion. Like, I have trouble saying how you can be a real, growing, maturing Christian and still be pro-abortion. But I don't have as much trouble with somebody who says, I'm not sure that we should still be practicing capital punishment. Because of the passage in the New Testament, like Nathan brought up, that would seem to suggest that mercy seasoning justice and forgiveness for sins is kind of the theme of Jesus' teaching. All that to say, I still believe that capital punishment is a proper biblical teaching and that I am pro-capital punishment done in the right way.
Do you think we're doing it right now?
Yeah, I actually think we're not being strict enough with it right now.
Because I feel like the way I feel like we're doing it now is like, okay, well, let's say double homicide. Yeah, you get the death penalty, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So that happens, but the way it's set up, I don't know if it's ever been like this, but the way I think it should be, it's like, okay, well, you killed someone or you killed a couple people and you get the death penalty. And then you have the trial, and then maybe like a week later, or you're about to, that's when you die. Not like immediately after, I mean, it could be a week, you get a week. But I feel like they're making it to where there's so many people, and we're trying to, like, I feel like we're trying to appease the public by making it, okay, well, we're not going to hang you, and we're not going to chop your head off. We're going to just inject you, but then we're going to make sure that we, you know, have all this injection stuff, but then it's like we're running out, I'm pretty sure, lately. Or we were running out or something.
Well, no, some people some people take more than others, and so people have suffered more because it's taken more to take them out.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the state's suffered running out.
The question of inhumane death penalty gets thrown into this equation. Also, I think a valid concern for Christians is the fact that we're not infallible. Even the system practiced properly can have flaws, and there can be people who are sentenced to death who are not guilty of crimes deserving of death. And so how do you deal with that as a Christian? Should I be for a system that still allows this to happen? Struggle with that. Don't.
Well, the other thing is the act of premeditation. And how much forethought went into the crime, and that you know, innate, you know, evidence. You know, we're pretty good with evidence and getting better at looking at how crimes were committed and what plans took place to put people in position to be able to do that. And so, there, you know, that's part of the assessment of a jury. You get tried for the crime, and then they actually have a separate trial or a separate session to decide the punishment for the crime. And I think the one you're talking about is capital murder.
Yeah, that's
where you're committing a crime and murder somebody in the act of a crime. That's usually punishable by death.
Yeah.
But it's not easy. I think I agree with what Steven said about, you know, we can't just automatically say that person should die. I don't think that's not the point of capital punishment. But I also don't agree that you can't use capital punishment as a deterrent, which is what it is. It is a punishment, but it is also to keep other people from doing
deterrent,
it.
Deterrent meaning, like, if you do this, this will happen to you? That
no, well, basically, it's preventing from happening again.
By letting that person
setting an example.
Okay.
For one person so that it would say, hey, if you do this, this is going to happen to you, so think twice before you do that.
Like right? When people would hang pirates and leave the method.
Right.
Yeah.
Opening up
right.
the city or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And so one of Josh's best friends killed, he and another guy killed an older couple in their house. It was, and they broke in. It was capital murder. And both of them were teen. They were 16. One was 16, one was 15. In the state of Missouri, they could have gotten the death penalty. They actually certified the 16-year-old as an adult. And
they tried him as an
adult. They tried him as an adult, and he could have gotten the death penalty, but by the grace of God, they didn't.
Wait, why didn't they?
They pulled it off the table. The judge pulled it up, didn't make that up. Or the DA, the DA didn't pursue it. Because
so
he
they
was
got
a
let
he was
they
no he's
they
in prison
life.
Right now he's
life?
In prison yeah
why never
mind. He's in prison until he's 65 years old. That's the earliest
he can
get out.
Might as well die then.
Well, but that's but,
yeah,
but that but that's the
in prison,
is it or, is it more of a punishment to kill that person as a capital punishment or to put them to take away their freedom for life?
But isn't that the same way as making them suffer, which is kind of sort of their it's kind of sort of the same thing as well if the medicine. Or the whatever the potassium crap that they use to inject you with, if that doesn't work, then you're basically like suffering.
Well, you're, so it's it, like, it is a what's it called? Golly.
The specific.
The word about capital punishment.
Humane.
Humane, but it's there's another word I'm looking
cruel
for.
Cruel and unusual.
Cruel and unusual.
Yeah.
Thank you. There is a, I mean, the Constitution talks about cruel and unusual punishment, and that's not allowed. That's why there is lethal injection. Although the electric chair was considered cruel, not cruel and unusual. Hanging, firing squad, guillotine. Those are all were considered inhumane. And they found out that when your head's cut off, you still live for 20 seconds.
So I wonder how they found that out.
I don't know.
You still not a whole lot of guys who are
someone
testifying.
Got
hey,
two. Got their
hey,
head two. Off
did that hurt?
Like, yeah, we gotta cut that out.
I can still wiggle my toes.
They just start talking.
Yeah.
Oh,
no, I don't know. I guess they test brain waves or something. I don't know. But anyway,
yeah.
That's just an example. But it, there's
so so that. I would just finish capital punishment off and say this is kind of a little bit more gray than some of the other topics we've covered. The essential components of both capital punishment and euthanasia are to remember that God is the creator and controller of both life and death. We don't get to decide where, when, or how we are born, and in His mercy, He's given us the ability to determine some end of life things. However, He is still an ultimate authority over that. So, capital punishment is one of those merciful ways that He's allowed us to determine death according to His will. But He's still in control. Like, and I almost flippantly, I'd say sometimes God just kind of doesn't care about life and death because He's just like, well, you know, I can bring him back. That seems to be his attitude towards death a lot in the Old Testament. He's saying, look, all that's going to happen to you is you're going to die. Like, you already knew that was coming. You've read Genesis 3. The focus is the resurrection. Am I going to bring you back? Sorry, what were you going
to
say?
I was just going to say, and he like refers multiple times in the New Testament to they're just sleeping.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, oh, yeah.
Like, they're just asleep.
Yeah.
Even when they say that they've died, he says, they're just asleep.
Yeah.
Jesus says, don't fear the one who can take your body, but fear the man who can take your soul.
Yeah. So there's that kind of like, God doesn't, do not take this the wrong way, but God doesn't like care too much about when we die.
Well, when we say care, it's not the issue. It's not
it's not his prime concern.
Right.
The resurrection is there, so he's not.
People
working.
Live and die.
Well, I mean, it's kind of true because people who are dying going to hell, he doesn't have a relationship with anyway.
Yeah.
And the people who he does, he's going to see later. So.
Yeah.
So it doesn't talk to
let's backtrack to euthanasia for a little bit. There was a thing in here that was really the key crux of the question of euthanasia, assisted suicide. Is this right to request that I be killed because of circumstances facing me? So that's usually how euthanasia comes about. It's you've been sentenced with some kind of you have 6 months to live, and so you say to your doctor, okay, well, just give me drugs to kill me now, so I don't have to go through the pain and Nathan put it, the embarrassment, which are like the horrible death of this disease, whatever, that's been given, sentenced to me. So just kill me now, and I get control over my death that way. And the central point is that we don't get to determine that. I think the Ecclesiastes 8 is an excellent kind of baseline to go from. God is in control of the day of our death.
Do you think DNR is the same thing as controlling it, or is it more like letting what happens happen?
DNR?
Do not resuscitate.
Oh, okay. My bad.
So you brought up a good point though, which we'll get into. The question of I think an important question with euthanasia is: are you taking action to end your life, or refusing to take action to prevent your death? That track.
Refusing to take action. Okay.
So if your doctor says you have 6 months to live, and if I give you this medicine, you'll live for 9 months. Are you morally obligated to take the treatment in order to extend your life? In the same way that you're morally obligated not to ask him to end your life. And I would say, and Nathan and I talked about this a lot when we were prepping this, and I think that there's more gray area in that.
Yeah.
But I also think it's valid, it's a very valid Christian view to say, no, there isn't, that you should be preserving life at all points. The point is, death is a contrast to life. Death is part of the curse, life is the gift and the blessing. And so anytime you are asking or focusing towards death, it's improper for the Christian viewpoint.
In Saul, with Saul in the end of 2 Samuel, when he asked his shield bearer to kill him, that's wrong. That's assisted suicide. He should not have asked for what he had asked for.
Yeah.
And he should not have fulfilled
his life.
Doesn't David kill the guy that?
Yeah, he went back and told him, and then he killed Noy.
He wasn't even telling the truth either, and he died.
Yeah, but he killed because he killed the Lord's anointed.
I mean, yeah.
Wait, but didn't Saul follow his brother?
Yeah, so he said,
because he didn't kill him.
He did?
It was because he didn't kill him.
Okay.
David killed him. Keep going.
Okay, so this is how it was. I may be wrong, but he asked this guy to kill him. He didn't. And then
Saul fell on his sword.
And then Saul killed himself, but then the guy went and told David that he was the one to kill him, thinking that David would be happy with him. And then he killed him for killing
him.
Saul.
Right.
Yeah.
Killed him.
So that's what you get for lying.
If you lie, you die.
Capital punishment. Killed by David.
If you lie, you die. Quote from
Denise. You had something.
Yes, I was just going to say,
just like
to do with euthanasia, just something to think about. In the last, the number four, where it says where will it stop? One of the things that came into my head, I don't know this for sure because I've never lived there, but in Canada they have. In other countries, they have socialized medicine. And I have heard it said that...
What's socialized medicine?
Socialized medicine means the government...
Government pays for it.
...is in control of it.
They get to make all the decisions on what treatment you receive.
And it takes 6 years for you to get in.
The way Stephen explained it was... That's kind of where I was going, was... At one point, at some point... I've heard it said that they, depending on how old you are, will depend on whether you get treatment or not.
Yeah.
The death panels.
Huh?
The death panel.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, that was part of Obamacare. But
that's part of the discussion of are you allowed to to bring into someone's age into a factor with socialized medicine of whether or not they'll receive their treatment.
Right. Because,
okay, this person's 85 and they have the same condition as somebody who's 65. Okay, we're only going to give it to one of them, so we'll give it to 65.
Because it's limited.
Okay. No, I want to explain it. So there was this. It's all right. There was this. There were these two patients in the show.
It's a show.
Grey's Anatomy. Anyways. There's this one lady, and she's been waiting on the UNOS list to get her name at the top to be able to receive this liver. And so she finally gets to the point where she's going to have it tomorrow, but this young 25-year-old comes in, and she has a condition to where she needs a new liver, and her sister can't because she's pregnant. So it's like, oh, cool, I'm pregnant. But whatever. Anyways, long story short, the lady says no. It's up to the lady to whether they could give her the liver, and then the old lady would go back on the transfer list. Mm-hmm. So I was telling him, I was like, well, I mean, I thought that was cool. Like, I mean, it kind of sucks for the girl. I mean, eventually she got a liver, she lived. But it was through other circumstances.
Oh, thank God.
But but anyways, I thought that it was okay for the old lady to say, I don't want to give the girl the liver that I've been waiting for 3 years for. And he was saying, I don't agree with that. Because she's older and she doesn't have a lot of time.
And there's this 20-year-old girl who
had her whole life for the head of her.
That's what he said.
Okay, so I mean, there's a 20-year-old girl who needs something to live. She's going to die right then. Or there's this lady who's going to have to wait another couple of months to be able to do it. She might be in pain for a few months, but this girl will live because of this lady's sacrifice, and this lady will have to be in a little pain for a few months.
But she still might die because she might not get a liver. That's what I'm saying.
That's the point I was trying to make. Is that like she may be waiting, and then she may die.
I mean, I would
because she decided to wait.
You would have given the girl the liver.
Yeah, she was way younger than me, and I was 80 something.
So let me speak.
But that's different because you have that choice. But if the government says no, you don't have that choice. We're going to make the decision for you.
Right.
That's wrong.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm just saying, that lady.
I wanted to make that distinction.
Well, let me speak to DNR because I had to go through this in January with my dad. So my dad had lung cancer. He's 69 years old, and the night that he died, we came in to the hospital and he had this. Yeah, I don't know if y'all know what a CPAP is, but it's a. Actually, the BPAP is a much bigger breathing thing. It was designed to push oxygen in and force carbon dioxide out. And so they kept that mask on, and it was doing its work. But they were going to run one more test, and we talked to the doctor at the hospital. It was me, my sister, and my stepmom. And... he came in and said that the cancer, he'd been receiving treatment for cancer, but the cancer wasn't getting better. It was progressing, right? And he said that if, you know, we're going to do one more oxygen test, and if depending on how it comes back, we may have to put him on life support. And then we could prolong his life, but the cancer is getting worse. And so we had to make a choice on whether to let them, you know, dad was unconscious. He was, you know, I won't say he was comatose, but he was out.
So you had medical power of attorney, essentially?
Yeah. Well, we had, yeah, his, yeah. What the doctor said was, we asked the doctor, and we said, well, you know, what's the prognosis? And he says he's not going to have a good quality of life. So my sister and I are believers, not real sure what my stepmom is. And so you have to face the choice of, can God heal my dad? The answer to that is absolutely. Absolutely he can. So it's not an issue of will he, it's, yeah, he can, but, so at that point,
So it is an issue.
And that his father is a believer, too.
Yeah, dad's a believer.
Because I think that...
But that was recent, though, right?
In January.
Yeah, that's...
So, anyway, so, you're... And then you go, and this is all going on in your head. And but then I remember a conversation I had with another doctor way back about how God has opened our eyes to how his creation works, how the body works. It helps us understand stuff like how cancer attacks the body, and there's just there's a point of no return. And so we basically decided that we were not going to put him on life support, and that we were just going to try to make him as comfortable as possible. And 4 hours later, my dad died. By God's grace. I mean, it was he went much faster than we thought he would. I mean, he just stopped breathing, and he died peacefully. My sister was there. And so, you know, we can sit here and throw around what we believe, but when it's, you know, when you've got one of your best friend's sons who's facing the death penalty, you're asking yourself, do I really believe in the death penalty?
Yeah.
Right? Or when your dad is on, you know, about to die, and you can save his life or extend his life, you put him on life support, you have to make those decisions. And I hope you guys never have to make those. I mean, it's not easy. But I can live here today. I can sit here and tell you this story with confidence. And maybe it's because my dad is with the Lord right now. He is in a better place. And my dad suffered with other physical issues for 4 or 5 years before he passed away. You know, there's a peace that comes with that. And I don't think for a second... Do I regret not trying to prolong his life? So you have to take all of those things into consideration.
Yeah, there's more gray.
Yeah, it really there is so there's I hate to use the word there's a relativism in that you know, if you want to talk about a liver, all of life has value, and you just wait your place in line. I mean, none of us should be putting value on an older person's life or a younger person's life. I don't know that that's the right way to approach it.
But that's what it's come to in society.
It is, and that's the way. That's what we've made in. That's what we've made it into. It's not. I mean, if I were sitting on a jury and was given the decision on whether or not to give a guy the death penalty or not. I don't want to have that choice, because there is no, you know, God's not going to write it on the wall whether or not you're going to kill that guy or not.
Like, could.
But. I'm saying, but I don't think he's going to. Yeah. There's no question that God is able. Yeah. That's never a question. It's not the way God works.
It's just probably not going to be what's happening.
Yeah, it's just not the way he works right now. So if you're a true dispensationalist, Stephen, you would say that was true, what you just said. But anyway...
The kind of the last thoughts to consider to add to your framework are I agree with a lot of what Clint was saying, that the two things. So the first thing is, as with the question of euthanasia, Christians deciding whether or not they want to have the quote unquote good death. The intent behind the choice is kind of key. If you're saying no, give me treatment to extend my life as long as possible because I'm afraid, I don't want to feel this pain, and I can't handle death, and I don't want to meet it, that's unhealthy for the Christian. The proper Christian attitude towards death is to look forward to it because of what comes after it, the resurrection. Paul says that all over the place. I would wish that I could be depart from here and be present with the Lord. And he faces death repeatedly with a smile. The prospect of dying, he says, I don't fear it because Christ's resurrection procures my salvation. Like I don't need to fear this thing. So your intent behind... am I going to take this medication and extend my life for as long as possible, or am I not, is much more important, I think, than the end result of which one do you do. And it might be that the proper motivation would be, I value life. Life is a good thing, and so I should be seeking to extend it as much as possible and to do fulfill the Great Commission as long as I can. And so, yeah, I'm going to extend my life by however long I can, because God has given us this ability through doctors to extend life and to make the time longer.
Unless even through the extension you cannot fulfill the Great Commission. Then your work is done, and you should
maybe
probably consider not.
Yeah, it's a very situational thing. However, the flip side of that coin is, it is never the good Christian response to ask for someone to administer death to you, to assist you in committing suicide. Essentially, usurping God's authority over your death. That is not the Christian attitude. You should not say, I'm going to take my life and my death into my own hands, and I'm going to make it come about when and how I want it to. That's not our prerogative as Christians. Our prerogative is to accept it when it comes, joyfully looking towards the resurrection, which is not to say, I'm going to make it happen right now. For whatever reason, if it's because I fear what's the pain that's ahead of me, because I don't want to see myself or my loved ones deteriorate and weep over me, whatever. It's, the Christian attitude is not to take your own death into your own hands.
I had once, before I was a believer, I had once someone tell me that the only unforgivable sin was suicide, because there was no taking it back. There was no
way to repent of it.
Yeah.
That's what the Roman Catholic Church teaches. So
this girl was a Baptist that told me this, so I have no idea where she got it or whatever, but I just wanted to make that comment.
But God is already forgiven us.
I know.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's someone that thinks
that is irrelevant
if they commit suicide, so that's why they're still here.
Yeah, the question of suicide itself is... The two thoughts to consider would be, Christ has paid for every sin, including murder, which would seem to include self-murder, which would be suicide. Right?
And then you take into every account that suicide has been rendered, and we see that it's not so new.
Yeah, well, the flip theological point would be, saving faith is one that trusts Christ in all situations, and one that looks to Christ in his resurrection for salvation from your sins, both the effects of them now and eternally. And so by taking your own life, it would seem to suggest that maybe you don't trust Christ, that you're saying, my current situations and my current failings and fears are bigger than Christ's power over this reality. And so the question is, do you really have a saving faith, or does Christ's death really pay for that sin? And I'm not confident in saying which one that is. I don't know for sure whether or not which one it is. I'm completely within God's character to forgive the sin, even the sin as heinous and wicked as suicide. However, it also makes logical sense to me that if you're taking your own life in your hands, you might not trust Christ as much as you claim to, and you should question whether or not you really do believe in the resurrection. So there's that tug of war. I don't know why I landed. What were you
saying? Yeah, no, that's... I was going to say or, but you had said it first about how... Is it truly trusting Christ for forgiveness?
Yeah. That's what makes suicide one of those really difficult questions to answer. Same with do babies go to hell? Because I don't know. Cannot answer that
question.
I'll
tell you when I get there.
We got 20 more minutes in our usual time. All right, anything else you guys wanted to talk about on these subjects? Want to just hang out and talk, or go if you need to?
Took a lot less time.
I'm noticing that all of these examples of capital punishment, none of them are in the New Testament. So does that mean that it was more specifically a Jewish thing, or did Jesus condone it and just he didn't say anything about it?
I'll let Nathan answer first, and I'll add any thoughts I have.
I'm sorry, I wasn't in the zone. The auto zone.
So if all these examples for capital punishment are in the Old Testament, is there any in the New Testament where Jesus okays it, or is does he not condone it?
I mean, I didn't look at that, no. I don't... I mean, he did die. So, I mean, he condoned his own death, even though it was wrongly accused. I mean,
he to his own capital punishment?
I mean, it's
wrongfully executed Jesus capital punishment.
He was basically murdered. Mm-hmm. The Pharisees killed him with hate in their heart. Mm-hmm. So.
It's really just...
That's true.
It's having that saving faith. It's rendering faith and to God, and that your situation will either lead you to Him or leave you alive and continuing to preach His word. I mean, it's I don't know. I had a good thought, and then it just disappeared. So.
The relevant passages, I would say, are Genesis 9. So that's pre-Mosaic law. So you can't make the argument that this is just for the Jews. So if this is just something that God laid out for previous times, it's not just for previous people groups, it's for the entire world in previous times. The New Testament passages that I think would be maybe relevant are Paul's talking about vengeance is mine, declares the Lord. I think that's in, he says it in First Corinthians and Romans, I'm guessing. Somebody wants to look that up. Where does Paul talk about you should not repay evil with evil, but overcome evil with good, vengeance is mine, declares the Lord. Anybody with a smartphone, feel free to do that. There's that, which, so are we supposed to be doling out revenge, essentially? Answer, no. Is that the same as capital punishment? Is the question. And then there's the fact that, I would say, okay, Revelation is coming in the future, and Christ pretty clearly condones his own slaughter of every unrepentant human that's left on the earth. And I would say it's through governmental force. Maybe you could draw that parallel that we have capital punishment in the Old Testament and capital punishment in the future. The only question is it's still in effect. I would say yes, because there's nothing that specifically says it's over.
And in Romans 13 it says that we're to be subject to the governing authorities. And so if we have capital punishment, then we're subject to that. And also when Paul was being tried before Caesar's tribunal, then he said he didn't condone capital punishment, but he said that he was willing to. He does not refuse to die.
Yeah, I'd say the question of so in all of these all of these questions that we're talking about, how do we as Christians behave within the system given to us is a different question than what should the system be. Does that track with y'all? Mm-hmm. My obligation to behave in a certain way as a Christian is different than my Christian view of how the system should work and how the system should be set up according to God's standards. So an example of this would be Paul's view of slavery. Okay, to slaves, he doesn't really ever come out and just condemn the institution of slavery like we would want him to. What he does is he tells slaves, in this situation, here's how you as Christians live. Be subject to your masters. If you can get your freedom, do it, but don't do it unlawfully, essentially. I know that this sucks. You're stuck in this system. Here's how you, as a Christian, behave in it. And the answer is be subject to God and work within the system that you have. Follow God. Treat your authorities as unto him. Like, be a Christian in this situation. So the personal responsibility of how to behave when we are faced with this situation is different than what the Christian view is. The Christian view, the proper system would be get rid of slavery. The abolitionists were correct in that one human should not be enforcing their will over another and enslaving others. And that's, again, Paul talks about that. It's not right for you to be an enslaver. He talks about it in 1 Timothy. He calls it a sin. So, do you see how there's difference there? Like, if you're in the system as a Christian, you're supposed to behave in a certain way, versus if you're talking about the system as a whole, is it right or wrong? That's a different conversation. Did that track? Did anybody just zone out for that?
Well, okay, so the right system, are you considering, like, New Earth?
So this is where I'm like...
Because, I mean...
Well, at that point, the system is the one given by God, and he's directly ruling over it, not mediating it through humans.
Are you saying whatever we can affect on our own will, what we should be trying to do and act in government is the...
Yeah, and that's where, like, in terms of capital punishment, if we're condemned to die according to these rules, and the Christian response might be to, as Paul and Jesus did, face death with a smile and accept the judgment, even though it is unjust that you should be killed for your actions. However, it might be that the Christian view is to abolish capital punishment. You have to determine that. But how I behave in the situation versus how the situation should be are two different questions. That's what I'm going to do. Same with euthanasia, or abortion. How I behave is I shouldn't have abortions. Christians do not have abortions. And how the situation should be is that abortion should not be available. So I think it's absolutely right for Christians to contend that abortion should be demonized in our culture and cast out and illegalized, made illegal. And also, Christians should not have abortions. But...
I was looking at about the revenge. The first one that I found was Romans 12:17, do not repay anyone evil for evil. But then there's also 1 Thessalonians 5:15, which says, make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always try to be kind to each other and to everyone else. And that took me to 1 Peter 3:9.
Yeah. Is that the word vengeance is mine, declares the Lord?
Yeah. Well, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing.
Yeah.
So it didn't, I mean, and then there's the one that you were talking about. I know that somewhere, but I just happened to be looking at her submission to authorities in chapter 13 of Romans, and it was right there in chapter 12.
Jonathan, another one that's relevant to the question of capital punishment is... James, I want to say it's chapter 2, might be the end of chapter 1, something along the lines of, I remember because of the Shakespeare passage, earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. James essentially says mercy is a quality, is a godly quality, and so when mercy is factored into our justice, it makes us more godly. And so should that be taken into account with capital punishment? Should we be extending mercy instead of enforcing death? All of those, I still, there's no clear passage that would seem to say that the Genesis 9 command off of the Noahic covenant, if man sheds man blood, whoever sheds blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, that is the instigation of capital punishment by God. And so there's nowhere in the Bible where he says, oh yeah, that's over now. Whereas we got plenty of places in the Bible where Jesus says that the law has been, he came to fulfill the law, and then the apostles all say, okay, we don't have to follow those rules anymore. So it's come to a close. Whereas that one, there isn't.
So it's maybe a thing like, we don't have to use capital punishment anymore. Like,
yeah, possibly. I can definitely respect Christians who are against capital punishment. I think they're wrong, and I hold a different view, but I'm...
Get support. There's no biblical mandate.
Yeah. I'm not going to be starting a new church over it. I will contend vehemently against Christians who are pro-abortion.
Yeah. That's why you have a bumper sticker on your car.
Yeah. That's the real question. If you believe it enough to put a bumper sticker on your car, that's how you know if you believe
something. That was on the trajectory.
I must truly believe that priests are terrible.
That was short. That was close.
Any last thoughts, questions, stuff to discuss?
John,
don't commit suicide just... if you get taken into captive.
Yeah.
Well, like,
no, I don't have a lot of
I did have this thought. Like, in old times, if like you warring, and the princess or whatever, or queen, or the they would kill themselves to avoid
capture
and
stuff like that.
Rape, yeah, stuff like that. So it wasn't necessarily because they were like sick of living or whatever. It was because
they wanted to avoid.
It was
suffering.
Because of the honor of their family. They didn't want to ruin that.
Yeah, I think they're still wrong.
Okay,
but I would say that probably
come out on the other side with an awesome testimony.
Well, yeah, I would say that probably their fear of what was going to happen to them is the main reason that they were killing themselves as a display that they did not trust God with the situation. They trusted themselves. To boil it down to that.
The thing, I didn't catch exactly what you were saying about the whole Shakespeare thing.
Yeah.
Was it mercy triumphs over judgment?
There you go.
Okay, yeah, that's James 2 at the, well,
middle of James 2. Middle of 2, okay.
What's
the full verse?
Well, it starts with 12. Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. So it kind of starts in 12. So 12 and 13, James 2.
Thank you. Dude. Yeah, that's my favorite Shakespeare show. It's Merchant of Venice, and it's during the courtroom scene.
The Merchant of Venice?
Merchant of Venice. Shakespeare's best book.